This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Unabomber was one of America's most notorious outlaws in the 20th century, and he may have never been caught if it weren't for a little help from here in Michigan. Premiering this past August on the Discovery Channel, the new show Manhunt Unabomber recreates efforts by law enforcement to nab one of the country's most wanted men. From 1978 to 1995, someone mailed or hand-delivered a series of bombs. Ultimately, three people were killed and 23 others were hurt. 18 years of fear ended April 3, 1996. That's when FBI agents swarmed a remote cabin in Montana and arrested Theodore Kaczynski. Retired FBI agent Greg Stascoll was based in Ann Arbor, and he helped the massive effort to find the Unabomber by snagging a crucial piece of information from the University of Michigan. Greg, good to see you.
Good to see you, Cindy.
This really was a national scare and an important example of homegrown terrorism, wasn't it?
It was, and it was, I want to say, unique. It was sort of the quintessential mad bomber kind of thing, and it went on for that long period of time.
Bombs were being delivered all over. It wasn't just was confined to one area, you know, across the country.
There were, and one of the most frustrating aspects for this long investigation was that it was difficult to find a common theme. The very name Unabomber comes from an effort to do that. It's basically an acronym of University and Airlines Bomber.
May 25th, 1978, it started with a bomb that injured a police officer at Northwestern University, and then 16 bombings over those 17 years. But it took a while to kind of find any kind of theme?
That's correct. It was very difficult. And, of course, we had one of the bombs here, the 10th bomb.
That's right, 1985. So one of these bombs arrived at the home of a University of Michigan psychology professor. Tell us about him and what happened.
Well, James McConnell was a psychology professor at the University of Michigan, had some notoriety, had written several books, and had done experiments regarding, for lack of a better word, not being a psychologist, but it had to do with manipulation of mind. And he did a lot of studies with flatworms. Flatworms are rather low on the feeding chain, but he was drawing conclusions based on human psychology, based on his experiments with flatworms. And as we learned later, that was one of the things that set off Ted Kaczynski and caused him to mail a bomb to Professor McConnell.
And what happened with Professor McConnell?
Well, the bomb was delivered through the mail and was delivered to his home. And one of his graduate assistants took delivery of the package. The bomb was contained. Professor McConnell, on occasion, would read papers and theses and things like that and comment on them. Ostensibly, that's what this was. It was a 5-pound package, and secreted inside a ream of paper, a hole was cut out in the paper, and the bomb was actually in there. And it was basically a pipe bomb using ammonium nitrate and powdered aluminum, which is like flash powder.
And how badly were they hurt?
Well, in that particular case, not too badly. The bomb was very carefully constructed. However, the classic pipe bomb uses threaded caps on each end, which causes the bomb, if you actually see it in slow motion, the pipe actually blows up like a balloon before it explodes. In this case, because the caps were made of wood, the ends blew out, and basically it caused this flash and explosion. So the graduate assistant was burned, not even severely burned, and there was significant damage to the kitchen where he was opening the package. But other than that, not too bad.
So, you know, everybody had to have been going, what's going on? There had to have been a massive investigation.
There was. And over a long period of time, many agents were assigned. I actually had I was case agent of the Ann Arbor bombing. But for a long time, you know, we covered all the usual leads and, again, tried to come up with a common theme, tried to do as much as we could to trace the package and everything. Ultimately, a task force was set up in San Francisco, and the reason San Francisco was chosen is a number of the bombs were mailed from San Francisco, and one of the newspapers that the Unabomber chose to communicate through was the San Francisco Chronicle. So the Unabomber task force was set up there. They did some tremendous investigation, setting up databases. They had literally thousands of suspects, but they were not able to come up with Ted Kaczynski or, you know, even any good solid leads that led anywhere until.
Until he insisted that a manifesto that he wrote be published. And you say without that, Kaczynski may have never been caught?
I think that's true. You know, it's hard to speculate what might have happened, but certainly he wouldn't have been caught as soon as he had been. And
what was in the manifesto? What was it that was helpful?
Well, it was a 35,000-word diatribe, and I guess it goes back to the adage, pride goeth before the fall. And he wanted to have his philosophy, the things that were causing him to do these bombings, he wanted that out there, his reasoning. And the manifesto, he wanted it printed in a major newspaper. There was a lot of controversy amongst the task force and the hierarchy at the FBI. And I should add that there were a couple other agencies involved in this investigation from the beginning, the Postal Service and the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. They all had agents assigned to the task force and were involved. But it was ultimately decided that if we put the manifesto out there and publicized it, that probably someone who knew Ted or was aware of his writings would come forward.
You could get an aha moment.
Exactly.
And his brother was coming forward.
Ultimately, it was his brother. First of all, we had to convince, well, we went to the New York Times and the Washington Post, and we had to convince the editors that this manifesto should be published. And they were reluctant. 35,000 words is a very expensive proposition for a major newspaper.
Plus, if you publish that, then the next character is going to want his stuff published.
Exactly.
Yes.
It's the thing of trying to negotiate with terrorists and that type of thing. At any rate, they were able to convince the New York Times and the Washington Post. A tactical decision was made to have it only published in the Washington Post. The reason for that is the Washington Post, at least during the week, is only available in San Francisco in two places. And again, the prevailing theory was that he was in San Francisco and that because of his ego or hubris, he would want to have a printed copy of his manifesto and see it in print. So the New York Times agreed to help finance the printing of the manifesto. The Washington Post agreed to publish it on a weekday, and we set up a massive surveillance in San Francisco, which resulted in nothing because, as we would later learn, he wasn't there.
He wasn't there.
But at any rate, fortunately, we actually received thousands of leads, and it was published in September of 95. But ultimately, it came to the attention of David Kaczynski, Ted's brother, and his wife. And his wife, Linda, had, for a period of time, had some suspicions that he might be the Unabomber. David, probably because he was his brother, didn't share that opinion. But she told him to read the manifesto, and he did. And then he, too, came to the conclusion that it was a strong possibility.
A light went on.
Yeah.
And then how did you fit into this, being able to get information from the University of Michigan?
Well, the task force had received these documents from David Kaczynski. They had been redacted. A lot of the personal information had been taken out, but there were a few things left in there. Joel Moss, who was a supervisor at the Unabomber task force, who I knew, called me and said, hey, we've got these documents, and they look a lot like the manifesto. There's a lot of wording and things that are very similar. And we've been able to determine, based on information left in the documents, that the individual who wrote these, first name was Ted, and that could either be Theodore or Edward. He had done undergraduate studies at Harvard and done graduate studies and may have received a graduate degree from University of Michigan and then went on to Berkeley. And they had determined that he was either born or grew up in Chicago. I think that was basically it. We had an age time frame, which turned out to be a little off because we weren't aware that Ted Kaczynski had skipped a couple grades. So consequently, with that information, I got a hold of a good friend of mine who was the assistant director of the Department of Public Safety at the University of Michigan. I knew full well I wouldn't get cooperation with Michigan, at least not easily. And I was afraid that a lot of this stuff would get out. So I called Jim Smiley. And to his credit, he never at the time asked me. I told him it was a very important and sensitive case, but I didn't tell him what case. He didn't question my sanity. He just said, well, let me see what I can do. And he got back with me within hours. I got the call from Joel Moss on February 12th in the evening, and Jim got back to me the following morning. And he said, I've got about five possibles, but only one of them seems to fit everything. And he's not perfect, but it's Ted Kaczynski. I immediately called Joel Moss and said, hey, I've got a name, Ted Kaczynski, explained to him. And he said, that sounds really good, and said something to the effect, at this point in time, you and I are the only ones who know who the Unabomber is, and you can't tell anyone. That began the full court press that we did with the surveillance in Lincoln, Montana, and everything else.
Ultimately sweeping in and arresting him. And he had the makings of another bomb in the cabin, didn't he?
He did. And the thing you have to understand is we knew at that point that he had written the manifesto, but that didn't prove he was the bomber. When they went to Montana, they were in the process and continued for about a six-week period writing the affidavit for the search warrant for the cabin. This was a crapshoot because it was one throw of the dice. If there had not been evidence in that cabin, we would have had a very difficult time determining that he was the Unabomber.
Based on the manifesto and once he was arrested and things he said, what was the overall point? What was he trying to prove with these bombs?
He was, as I understand it, he subscribed to the philosophy of being a Luddite. And a Luddite is, you know, somebody that is opposed to technology. And that basically was his philosophy. And he felt that technology was not serving humankind. In effect, technology was controlling humankind. And there's, you know, quite frankly, there's a lot of things in his philosophy that make a lot of sense.
It's just the problem that he was backing them up by sending bombs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I should stress that when we did go into the cabin, we didn't have an arrest warrant when we did the search. We did the search, and in there was, even though he had promised that when he did the manifesto, he would not send any more bombs, or at least not target people. But in the cabin was an anti-personnel bomb, and when I say that, it had shrapnel in order to kill people. And that was actually ready to go. It was all packed up and ready to be mailed. There was also materials to make bombs. He left a journal that basically explained all of the bombings and how he had made them. Lists of addresses where the bombs had gone. We found the typewriter that he typed the manifesto on. So it was a treasure trove of information.
And he's in the Supermax prison, isn't he?
He is, you know, and it's interesting. He had written in his diary, and I got a copy of it from Joel Moss. He had written in his diary when he was at the University of Michigan, which he considered some of the worst days of his life for some reason. But at any rate, he had written that he had decided that it would be okay to kill people. But his biggest fear was that if he killed someone, not that he would be executed, but that he would have to spend the rest of his life in jail. That seemed to be his worst nightmare.
And think about it, that Colorado Supermax prison, I think they're locked up 23 hours a day, aren't they?
That's correct.
Well, it certainly shows there are many, many cogs in turning the wheels of an investigation. There's no one person that can be taking a bow. It certainly was a massive effort.
This was a huge team effort. And people have said to me after the fact, you know, you identified the Unabomber. And I said, not really. I was just a cog in a big machine that was moving inexorably towards identifying Ted. And everybody played a part, and I actually played less of a significant part than a number of other people, like the guy that wrote the search warrant, Terry Turchi and Jim Freeman. These guys talked the Bureau and the New York Times and Washington Post into printing that manifesto. All of these things contributed to it. Unfortunately, there's a lot of people after the fact that have tried to take credit for a number of things, and it really was a great, tremendous team effort.
One of the most historic and notable cases, notorious cases, we should say, from the 20th century, the Unabomber. Retired FBI agent Greg Stascoll, thanks so much for the story.
You're welcome, Cindy. Thank you.